Every year, Bible Study Fellowship, which meets here on Wednesday mornings, the women's BSF meets here. They always have the local pastor come in and give a greeting and a welcome. And I always tell them, I say, study, but studying is a means to a greater end. It's not the end in and of itself. And I really do think the Christian church in our country, that's where we've got to. We just like knowing. We like knowing and learning and voicing our opinions. And ultimately, when we think about the church's influence waning, it's because we've sequestered ourselves in our own houses to read and study and learn, and we haven't taken that as motivation and incentive to go back out and do the work of the church. You know, God's calling on us is to be agents of change in the world, to proclaim the good news and to lift up the needy and the poor and to reach out to those that are hurting. That's the job of the church, and knowledge helps us to do that better, helps us to know God better. And so I always challenge them. I say, let your study and your knowledge be a means to another end, not an end in and of itself. And I always approach our conversations, hopefully, with the same goal in mind. We're going to be on this set of notes. This is Lecture 7 at the top, first. And some of this may be material that you guys have covered. We're really just going to look at a small portion of it. The chapters in the book, if you're following along, this is chapters 32 and 33 tonight. And 31, which Garrett looked at last week, it's kind of as we move into the 20th century, the 19th and 20th century, he talked about what's going on in the Protestant world, Protestant theology and development, philosophy. Protestants were the liberals of the day, all right? That was that they were looking, because everything that was conservative was Catholic. And if you didn't want to stay in the past and remain close to tradition, if you were breaking away from the Catholic Church, if you were reforming, then you were liberating yourself and liberating the church to move forward in new directions. And so all of that stuff in Protestant theology that in many cases we would hold to be very, very conservative today, was very, very liberal back then. And the Catholics, of course, were the model of conservatism, at least in the religious vein, because what they were trying to do was conserve everything about Catholicism that that had made Catholicism what it was. And so chapter 32 looks at some of the same trends going on in the Catholic world during that time period that we looked at in Protestant theology last week. I am admittedly not a Catholic scholar by any means, and so there may be some of you guys that know a lot more about the Catholic Church than I do. I'm still learning, always in the process of learning new things. It's interesting to me, though, that when you think about Europe especially, as we move into the 19th century, the 1800s, 1900s, countries kind of, they take on their own Christian identity. And even today, when you think of Italy, Italy's Catholic. When you think of England, England is Anglican. When you think of Germany's Lutheran. When you think of France, France is predominantly Catholic. When you think of Spain, Spain's predominantly Catholic. When you think of Russia, Russia's predominantly Orthodox. It's interesting when you read about all of this moving around, in that the political world, with the papacy being a political entity, really pushed and pulled and influenced both people that drew near to the Catholic Church and also people that pushed away from the Catholic Church. As the Catholic Church sought to control more, some people embraced that. Some countries did. If it served their political interests, they embraced that. And if it didn't serve their political interests, then they pushed away from it. There's a member at the gym that I talk with on occasion when I'm there, and her family's from Poland. Guess what religion she is? Guess what version of Christianity she is? Anybody know what Poland predominantly is? Yeah, it's Catholic. Why is Poland Catholic? It's because it sits between Russia and Germany. And forever, the Russians and the Germans were fighting over and trying to conscript land in Poland. And so as Poland had, the countries would be identified with their version of Christianity. And so the Russian Orthodox folks are trying to take land from this side. The German Lutheran Protestants are trying to take land from us here. And so who can we turn to for help? Well, we turn to the Pope. Yeah, we turn to the Pope. And the Catholic Church, of course, if we could bring people back into the fold, we'll be happy to go to war, to send armies, to do whatever we have to do. And so it's, you know, Poland's story is, in this history, you read the same about Spain. You can read the same about Germany. And the challenges between France being predominantly Catholic and all the going back and forth between Germany and France. Well, France is Catholic, then Germany and the Netherlands, Holland, became a safe haven for Protestant reformers moving out of Italy and France. And all of a sudden, the Netherlands is predominantly known as being Protestant. Germany as Lutheran. And even today, while a lot of those places are much more multifaceted, those stereotypical characteristics still are in place. The Catholic Church's influence over both Italy and France being Catholic and Spain being Catholic, and Britain and Germany and Holland and Russia not being Catholic, was equal. The Catholic Church's influence was equal in all those cases. It just depended on, did it serve the best interests of the Catholic Church, and did it serve the best interests of who happened to be the political leader of the other countries at that point in time? It's what makes looking at the development of Christianity in the United States so much more interesting. Because when you have all of these colonialists moving here, the reach of the Pope in Italy and their influences here were very small. I mean, you had Spanish influence and French influence, but you also had, everyone was on a level playing field. And the United States became a melting pot, not just of cultures and ethnicities, but their religions as well. And if you'll recall, the Catholic Church really started out kind of at the bottom of the rung in the United States. Many more of the Protestant denominations had more influence early on. Now the Catholic Church caught up quickly, it's hard to underestimate. Whenever you hear people make comments about the Catholic Church and the Pope, and they make grand statements either about its goodness and its value or its badness and its trouble, the answer is yes to both. The reality is yes. And it just depends on which pope you're talking about and which era in history you're talking about. But the Catholic Church was always, the church is the government kind of mentality. And as we move further and further into the Protestant world, the Protestants are going to begin championing separation of church and state, in large part because they've seen what happens when the church and state are wed together, how the church usually gets abused. It gets used as a tool to serve the political interests of whoever is in charge of the government. And so this that we champion as, in our country, as part of our constitutional, constitutional rights, part of our American identity, part of our freedoms, separation of church and state, and that people live here and value the separation of church and state but also practice Catholicism, that's a little bit of an oxymoron. That those don't go together, at least historically speaking. The Catholic Church was very much, we govern, we control, we're controlling our faith, and in the context of doing so, but the Catholic Church has evolved, the same way most all of our other versions of Christianity have evolved. But big ships turn slowly, and the biggest of ships turn slowest of all. And so that's kind of been their story as well. The chapter here in Gonzalez's book is just kind of a summary of the popes, beginning with the period of Napoleon, early 1800s, and moving up through past World War II. The French Revolution, Pope Pius IX, this is on page 401, and in the notes, These notes have a lot of stuff going on in Europe, French Revolution. It's not exclusively about the Catholics. You see under Napoleon Bonaparte B, beginning with Pius VII, Napoleon took the Vatican in 1808. Napoleonic Wars ended in 1815. A lot of this is just French Revolution, not pertaining to the Catholic Church. Here we go. This is the third page. It says page 148 at the bottom. For our purposes, it's page 3. Revolution of 1848. If you look down under Italy, see, the Revolution of 1848, with the French Revolution going on, this was an economic thing, all right? It's a product of the Industrial Revolution. It's a product of more and more people living in urban centers and the poor amassing in certain areas and living in squalid conditions. It's a product of the wealthy becoming more and more wealthy and the poor becoming more and more poor. And so the French Revolution was a product of these economic and societal trends, but the Industrial Revolution was going on everywhere, and as the revolutions are rising up, things that we've seen in recent years in Egypt, in efforts in Syria now, the people rising up to protest poor living conditions and unfair government. It's interesting what's going on in the middle, all over the Middle East, North Africa right now. That's what was going on in Europe in the 1800s. It's just a couple of hundred years after the fact. But everybody else was watching French Revolution and worrying about if that's going to come to us. And so particularly in Italy, the popes were very concerned about making sure we keep things in control and we don't have an uprising here like they had there. Pius IX, that's a trivia question answer. What Catholic pope had the longest tenure? Pius IX. Is that right? He was exiled. I think that's correct. Is it Pius IX or Pius XII? It's Pius IX, I think. That was World War II. Pius IX was the longest. Exiled in 1848, but then returned. His predecessor was taken by the French and put in prison in France under Napoleon's reign and died in France, died in prison. And so Pius IX, with that in the rearview mirror, was exiled. But then after the fall of the revolution, he was able to return home. Upon his return to Rome, he reacted to all political and religious progressivisms. In other words, we are going to be as conservative as we possibly can. Moving towards unifying all of the nation states in Italy. Near the end of this period, Pius IX lost most of the papal states, Bologna, Romana, the Marches. You know, papal states were all over the region of Italy, to where now Vatican is the only one you think of, and I'm not sure if that's the only one still in place. That's where we need Garrett to answer that. At the last count, there were three. There was Vatican City, there was Lateran, and there was a castle. But I think what's qualified as papal state now is Vatican, and that is it. You see, Napoleon III of France intervened, prevented the total absorption of those papal states until his fall in 1870, when King Victor Emmanuel II finished the unification process by capturing and annexing Rome. Pius IX reacted with policies intended to strengthen papal ecclesiastical power. Ecclesiastical, a big word for meaning church power. In other words, this political stuff is going on, and Italy wants to be unified. Instead of being a bunch of nation states like the U.S. was a bunch of colonial outposts, we want to unify as a political entity, political country. Well, how does the Pope and the Catholic Church feel about that? We've been in charge here forever and ever, going all the way back to Constantine in Rome. 1600 years, roughly. 1600 years. And all of this consolidation of states into a single power meant the Pope was losing control, political control. And so what Pius IX begins doing is there's nothing he can do about political power and political control in Italy. And so he, like stubborn children often do, when I can't control this area, and sometimes stubborn adults, when I can't control this area and I totally lose control, I'm going to respond by going and excessively demonstrating my control and power somewhere else where I do have the ability to do that. Y'all don't ever do that, right? Yeah. You never worked with anybody that did that. I lose control here, so I go overboard here. And that's what he does. He begins, if I can't control what's going on politically, nationally, then I can't control what's going on in the church, and I'm going to wield my power in excessive ways, more than I otherwise would. What Pius does is, this is in the book on page 401, in 1854, he proclaimed the dogma of the Immaculate Conception of Mary. Immaculate Conception of Mary. It's tied today to Catholicism almost as much as the Pope is. But in the history of the church, it only goes back about 150 years. Doesn't go back to Constantine. Doesn't go back particularly that far. And it came about under duress, under a pope who was losing power in one area and said, I'm just going to issue a dogma, a statement of theological dogma, so that I can show that I still have power over something. And so he... The doctrine, by the way, the Immaculate Conception of Mary, is that Mary, by virtue of her election to be the mother of the Savior, was kept pure from all sin, including original sin, as understood by the Catholic Church. That Mary was sinless, perpetually. This was one of those things where this was the first time ever. Normally, whenever the Pope wanted to issue a new statement on dogma, they would gather a council together. And they would debate and talk and decide, and then the council would issue the statement or the decree. The first time in the Catholic Church's history that a pope, without a meeting of a council or a word of a council, a pope just said, this is now dogma within the Catholic Church. Very suspect. Not only that it was the first time that it happened, but it happened under such political circumstances. But what it did was, the Catholic Church... The members of the Catholic Church, the leaders, cardinals, things like that, and Gonzalez mentions this. He says, since the bull did not meet much opposition, the stage was set for it to roll downhill. And what would happen is this is going to lead to the Catholic Church's statement on the infallibility of the Pope. The infallibility of the Pope. I don't know how many, if any of you guys... If you got a copy of the book, if not, let me read some of these to you. This happened about 10 years after that. In 1864, Pius IX issued an encyclical. It was called Quanta Cura, and along with that was a syllabus of errors in which the Pope listed 80 propositions that all Catholics must reject. These are error statements. That every person is free to adopt and follow that religion which, guided by the light of reason, he shall consider true. False statement. That the method and principles by which the ancient scholastic doctors developed their theology are not compatible with present needs or scientific progress. Error. Cannot accept that. That Protestantism is simply another form of the same Christian religion, and it is possible to please God in it as well as in the true Catholic Church. That's a statement of error. All Catholics must reject it. That the Church does not have the power of defining dogmatically that the religion of the Catholic Church is the only true religion. Not a true statement. You have to reject that. Et cetera, et cetera. It lists a number of these things, but this was another one of those instances in which, because of the statement on the Immaculate Conception of Mary, Pius IX didn't meet any opposition, and so I grasp a little bit of power. Nobody makes a big deal about it, so I'm just going to grasp more and more and more, ultimately leading to this statement of the what we call papal infallibility. I think he has. No. He's got it in here. Well, let me see if I can find this real quick. First Vatican Council under Pius IX. He doesn't give a date. Pius IX was operating during the time of Napoleon, and so it might have been concurrent. Now, this was council. This was conciliar, though, instead of just the Pope issuing it. It says, therefore, faithfully adhering to the tradition received from the beginning of the Christian faith, for the glory of God our Savior, the exaltation of the Christian religion, and the salvation of Christian people, the Sacred Council approving, we teach and define that it is a dogma divinely revealed that the Roman Pontiff, when he speaks ex cathedra, meaning out of the church, I believe, cathedra, Latin, how's your Latin, everybody? That is, when in discharge of the office of pastor and doctor of all Christians, by virtue of his supreme apostolic authority, he defines a doctrine regarding faith or morals to be held by the universal church, by the divine assistance promised to him in blessed Peter, is possessed of that divine infallibility with which the divine Redeemer willed that his church should be endowed for defining doctrine regarding faith or morals, and that therefore such definitions are irreformable of themselves and not from the consent of the church. So that's First Vatican Council. It was significant that the statement said only whenever the Pope is speaking ex cathedra in his role as the Pope, because they could look back at previous incarnations of the Pope and say, well, this guy, he lied about this, and this guy lied about that, and they would say, well, that was not in his operating in the role of the Pope. He was just, you know, I don't know, being a husband or being a dad or being, probably wouldn't be a husband or dad. Maybe. Depending on who it was again. But they put that qualifying statement in there, and that it had to be in the Pope speaking in his official capacity as such, but in doing so was infallible. That he was blessed by God to speak infallibly on any of these matters. So, Pius IX, longest tenured Pope, the Pope during the unification of Italy, which was significant, the Pope who ushered in the infallibility clause at First Vatican Council. This is in your notes on under C, Italy, number 4. Roman Catholic steps to increase papal authority at the bottom of the page there. Dogma of the Immaculate Conception. And then on the next page, the encyclical Quanta Cura with the syllabus of errors. And then C, the First Vatican Council. You see, under First Vatican Council number 2 on July 18, 1870, in its dogmatic statement, there's our date. The council proclaimed the dogma of papal infallibility. Of course, if you look at number 4, the First Vatican Council led to a schism from the church because you had modernists in the Catholic Church at that time. And as the Catholic Church insists on being conservative, you have modernists that decide to leave. This, by the way, the Catholic Church went through that during this time period. We've seen just about all of the major Protestant denominations go through that in the last 50 years, in our lifetime. We've seen Baptists, Presbyterians, Methodists. As we gain a little bit more traditionalism, and as culture continues to progress and evolve and move forward, you have those long-standing Protestant denominations that want to conserve the old way, and you have modernists within their churches that say this is no longer effective, or it doesn't seem to be as effective as it once was, and so we have this whole new thing called non-denominational churches. What does that mean? I mean, every church is, the writer of Ecclesiastes would say, there's nothing new under the sun. All these non-denominational churches are in line with the traditional denominations. They just don't necessarily call themselves as such, or partner with some of those larger entities or agencies. But theologically, in other words, in practice and in partnership, they may be non-denominational. In theology, there really probably is no such thing at this point unless you're a cult, you know, unless you're believing something totally unorthodox and non-biblical. But the Catholic Church, again, they came first, and so they went through their little conservative versus modernist schism first. We've all seen some of that taking place. The worship wars is a great example. Are we going to have hymns and an organ? What does a church do? We're in a fortunate position of being a church that has two worship services and means and resources to have leadership to lead, to run both of them. What do you do if you're in a church where you have the kind of makeup we do, but only enough time and resources to do one worship service? And you have 650 people that want one, and you have 350 people that want the other. What do you do? Yeah, it's... Fortunately, we don't have to make that decision, but I've got friends in ministry that have. They try to blend it, and that, instead of making everybody happy, does what? Makes everybody mad. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And so that's why you find churches that say, look, we're just going to pick one. And because this is the one that seems to be more progressive, it's what younger churchgoers want, we're going to go with the more progressive model. And again, we are incredibly fortunate that we are able to do both. We find value in both. We have people that appreciate both. And that's in large part because of our size and our resources. If we were a lot smaller, we wouldn't have the freedom or luxury to do that. That was a little rabbit chasing for you. Sorry about that. Pope Pius, that brings us to the end. Germany, the law of papal guarantees, they're the end of the 1800s. And as far as the Catholic stuff, I think that's as far as these notes go. After Pius IX, Gonzalez covers Leo, who was almost as long tenured as Pius IX. Leo XIII, he was a reformer of sorts. If you compare, in our modern day, Pope John Paul, who was much more conservative, you know, upholding, you know, the old way of doing the Catholicism in the church, versus now Pope, what's his number? Benedict? Is he Benedict? Francis. Benedict was the one in between. Francis, I don't know what number he is. Is he the first Francis? Okay. Francis the First would obviously be a much more progressive or modernist Pope. That may be hard to imagine. But, I mean, he's doing things and saying things that are unheard of in the Catholic Church in probably our lifetimes. And so, whereas Pius IX was very conservative, trying to cling to the past, and that alienated some people, Leo XIII came in behind him and was a swing back. He was a pendulum. Pius IX was conservative. Leo III would be a progressive of sorts, as progressive as you can be and still be the Pope. Now, we're not talking about radical liberalism here, but for a Pope, as far as Popes go, he was relatively progressive. Pius X came after that, was about a 10-year tenured Pope. After that, Benedict the 15th, Pius the 11th, and then the one that's most interesting for our purposes, Pius the 12th, 1939 to 1958. The Catholic Church was in an interesting place with the rise of fascism in Italy and Nazism in Germany. And Pius the 11th, he was on board with fascism at the beginning. It seemed like it would benefit the church. The Catholic Church's response has always been, what benefits the church? And it seemed to benefit the church. It didn't seem to be too problematic. As time would go on, it became readily apparent that this was not something that the church could stand behind. Early on, the church, Pius the 11th, here's the X factor. The popes and the Vatican were enemy number one during this time period is who? That's what you have to keep in your mind. Enemy number one, who, but also what system of government. communism. The communists, wherever they might be, are public enemy number one for the Catholic Church. And so when it comes to fascists and Nazis and communists, communists, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, you know, that kind of deal. It might not have been that they were really on board with some of these other things in the early stages, but the fascists weren't communists. The Nazis weren't communists. And so in Germany, this is page 410 if you have a book there with you, there was fear of liberalism, fear of communism. And so what did many Catholics in Germany incline towards? We're afraid of communists, we're afraid of liberals, and so we lean towards the Nazi Party because they're anti-liberal and anti-communist. Now, this is before the Nazi Party was, you know, full-blown in the early days, but the Catholics kind of, the same thing in Italy. We're anti-communist, we're anti-liberal, and so we side with the fascists in Italy. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The statement for the recording is that the Nazis were the socialists, but they were not against religion. They weren't anti-God in that context. And so this put the Pope, Pius XI and Pius XII, once the development that would become World War II became full-blown, and we start seeing mass massacres of Jews, of Catholics in Poland, put the popes in a precarious position because they're in Italy. And, you know, in Italy, Mussolini's in Italy. And so Pius XII really took a lot of heat during his papacy and after for being so tight-lipped. Their official statement was they were going to remain neutral so that they could be an arbiter whenever the time came necessary for there to be an arbiter. Well, but then the opponents would come in and say, well, you kept your mouth shut whenever all of these Jews were being killed, but you did make a ruckus whenever Catholics in Poland were being killed. And so it wasn't that you were completely neutral, you were just selectively neutral as it served the church's and the Pope's best interests. Let's not throw rocks too harshly. Being the Pope in Vatican, in Italy, during that time period, had to have been a precarious position indeed. We love to tell the story of Dietrich Bonhoeffer in Germany as a Protestant Christian leader speaking out against the atrocities that were being done, being put into prison, being executed before the fall of the Axis powers. But Bonhoeffer he wasn't the only one, but stories like that Bonhoeffer wasn't the Pope. And so, but at the same time, Pius XII's legacy will go down as being the Pope during World War II and not saying anything or doing anything about the Holocaust of the Jews. The Pope didn't do anything. So, tough legacy, tough time, but with great power comes great responsibility, and certainly there was an opportunity there that he did not take advantage of. So, the Catholic Church, when you think about the 1800s, even a lot of this stuff going on in the 1800s was very beneficial for Protestants, very tough for Catholics, because what Pius IX represented for that little window of time, that is a microcosm of what was going on in Catholicism, really from the Reformation until the early 1900s. The Catholic Church had lived in a place where they were king. They controlled the landscape of Christianity for the entire Western world. And with the start of Martin Luther's 95 Theses on the Wall, and the spread of the Reformation, and you get into these new industrial developments, these new intellectual developments. We have Darwin saying these things, and we have Immanuel Kant and his philosophies, and we have a new understanding of the cosmos. The Catholic Church, that was the epitome of conservatism, cling to the past, hold to tradition, we want to be in control, nothing was going their way. And for new groups, for Baptists, us, Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians, Lutherans, we were then the non-denominationalists now. We didn't have any traditions that we had to be beholden to. And so all this new progressive stuff that was going on, the Protestant denominations could say, sure, we don't have a problem with the industrial movement. We'll take advantage of it. We'll go into these slums and minister to people. In England, William Wilberforce, he says, we'll be a force towards the freedom of slavery and the end of the slave trade. You know, you're going to see in the missionary movement, we'll go to other parts of the world. Colonialism is dead, but we'll go to other parts of the world to spread the gospel. A lot of the traditionalism, if we're not bound by it, then we are free to practice Christianity in the modern climate in whatever ways we find to be effective at advancing the kingdom and spreading the gospel. And for about 100, 150 years, the Catholic Church has fought and fought and fought to hold on to its past and hold on to its territory, and with gradually losing ground all along the way. You get into the 1900s, really post-World War II even, and the Catholic Church all of a sudden starts turning a corner with modernity, the modern world, and, you know, we're not so anti-Protestants anymore. We're not going to put out a statement that says, if you're a Catholic, you have to reject the notion that a Protestant can also be a Christian. Well, they may believe that. Not that I know of. Not that I know of. But you wouldn't hear them preach it, I don't think. They may believe it, but they've turned a corner, and we see that today. The Catholic Church perhaps now is probably as popular as it's been in a long, long time, probably in our lifetimes. A lot of that is the Latin America. I mean, it is the predominant religion, period, for everything south of the U.S., all the way to Antarctica. It predominates. And you know, having a cool pope, a trendy pope that's pushing the boundaries and talking about things nobody else has talked about and being willing to change, maybe not everything, but just things that the Catholic Church hasn't talked about ever. And it's good for publicity, good for marketing. And ultimately, I mean, Vatican and the Pope's influence over, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people across the globe that believe the Bible and profess to be followers of Jesus, for them to be rounding a corner and thinking progressively and being willing to advance is a good thing. It's a good thing. Now, that any one church or any one leader should have that much influence and authority over that many people, well, that's always a scary thing. That's a frightening thing, whether it's a religious leader, political leader, you know, celebrity, whatever. But for now, you know, it seems to be moving in a good direction. But those are just some trends, the way I see them and the way that I've read about them and to my understanding of Catholicism moving mid-1800s to World War II and from World War II even up till today. So, you have any comments, rebuttals, corrections? I mean, again, I'm not the expert on this. So, certainly not the expert. And the more that I learn, the more I realize all the things the Catholic Church has gone through, the Baptist Church goes through. You know, we become entrenched in our tradition. We wrestle with progress. You know, we have good leaders, we have corrupt leaders, systems, and every denomination, as it gets bigger and has more money and has more people and has more influence, it's especially those of us that have grown up Baptist forever. I know some of you probably come from other traditions, Methodist or Presbyterian. We should be very, very cautious about throwing rocks at the Catholic Church, lest we look at ourselves and see if some of those tendencies don't illustrate us as well. You know, the Protestants broke away from the Catholic Church because they felt like tradition and the leadership had more power and influence than the authority of God's Word. Sola Scriptura, Scripture only, as our authority, was one of the championing slogans of the Reformers. And today, most Protestant churches would say the same thing. Oh, we believe the Bible is our primary authority. That's what we... But as you think about how churches operate, we can say the Bible is our primary authority, but isn't it the case that pastoral leaders, denominational leaders, tradition, the way we've done things, probably in practice carry more power and authority than the Bible does in our Protestant denominations today? We follow the same track as the Catholic Church. The pieces are different. The names are different. But human nature, again, there's nothing new under the sun. What is old will become new. What is new will become old. This is, you know, it rains, the waters run to the ocean, but the ocean never fills up. Somehow the water gets back to the mountains and comes down again. Human nature. So that was a lot of time on Catholics. The other set of notes that you have is the missionary movement, missionary expansion. And we love this part as Baptists because this is one of what today has been the Baptist's greatest contributions to global Christianity. Once we move out of colonialization, well, the colonialization, that's Dutch and French and Spanish settlers going in and colonizing India, Burma, setting up trade in China, setting up colonies in Africa, South Africa, places like that. There was always, just like in Europe, government and religion kind of went hand in hand, but they never really could agree on how it worked. In other words, if the missionaries come into our colonial settlement in Indonesia and they're riling up the locals and their traditional religion and causing problems with our making money and trade, then all of a sudden we don't want religious missionaries going with us anymore. And for the missionaries, if we go in here and we're trying to love people and share the gospel with people, and these merchants and traders keep coming in and starting fights and arguing and yelling, then the locals hate all of us, regardless of whether we're starting a fight or we're trying to share Jesus with them. It was an open door. Colonialism was an open door for missionaries, but it wasn't always seamless. But as colonialism kind of starts to plummet, this was still, you still had Protestants especially that began feeling our call to go and take the gospel, take the truth or the beliefs about Christianity to other parts of the world. It's a good chapter in Gonzalez's book, chapter 33. He talks about the spread into Asia. A lot of the early pioneering missionaries were in China, in the Indian subcontinent, which now is India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, also into Africa. Let's see, on these notes, we're going to skip Second Great Awakening, the West and South, and Finney. This is page 100 at the top corner. B, early missionary activity. By the way, the way it started was you had religious organizations form societies. That's what they called them. A group of people that were raising awareness and raising funds and sending people. That was today we have all kinds of missionary agencies. We call them agencies. Back then they called them societies. And the two forerunners came out of the Anglican Church in Britain. A very interesting story. William Carey, widely considered to be the father of the modern missionary movement. You see him listed there. William Carey was born into an Anglican family. Became Baptist later on. Felt a deep passion for the people of the Indian subcontinent. Formed a society. Does it have the name of his society on here? We wrote this inquiry, and then his society, number three, the particular Baptist Society for the Propagation of the Gospel Among the Heathen. It's not exactly today a politically correct name for your organization, but it got his point across. And later on that would become the Baptist Missionary Society, much better. But they sent Dr. John Thomas and William Carey as the first missionaries to India in 1793. They started in Calcutta. Calcutta was a trade hub. Both the British and the Indian locals only wanted so many in Calcutta, and so Carey moved his base of operations to Serampore. And that's where, you know, one of the early missionary, the father of the modern missionary movement began. Carey was a linguist, was a gifted linguist, and the statistic is that he translated the Bible into 35 different languages before his death. Now, from there, thence on, people love to throw rocks at Carey and how bad his translations were, because he didn't have mastery of any of these languages, but he was able to learn enough about them to translate a Bible that then could later on be amended and corrected and, you know, made better. Man, I couldn't even do that for one other language, much less 35. And so that they weren't flawless translations, I mean, we should maybe cut the guy some slack. 35 translations of the Bible is pretty impressive. You see the principles of their agency there. Preach the word, translate it, print it. Indigenous missions, and they were big on interdenominational cooperation with their society. A lot of missionary agencies were fans of interdenominationalism. When you're home and it's comfortable, then we can fight. We talked about this throughout this course. When we're here and it's affluent and it's comfortable and it's safe, then we can fight over theology and doctrine all we want. When we go into another place where we're the 1% and we're fighting for survival and we don't have that many friends and that many churches, all of a sudden the fringe stuff really is fringe and the core stuff is much more core. And denominationals that would fight with one another in Europe all of a sudden would get along and cooperate and help one another in India and in China. Something there about, you know, when fishermen don't fish, they fight. And so if you're a fisherman, you ought to be fishing. That's an old preacher story I'll tell sometime maybe. Home missions in the U.S. on that page. You see the New York Missionary Society, predominantly Presbyterian, Baptist, Dutch Reformed. Congregationalists. The Congregationalists, there was a Christian Congregationalist named Adoniram Judson who got on a boat to go to Burma as a missionary. On the way, he became a Baptist. He transitioned from Congregationalist to Baptist on the boat headed to Burma, modern-day Myanmar, and is very prominent in Baptist history as a missionary figure. Is he on here anywhere? Williams College. Oh, yeah, on the back page, Baptist missions. Adoniram Judson and Luther Rice among the first missionaries to India. They ended up in Southeast Asia instead. Hudson Taylor is another well-known missionary name, started a mission in China. Betty, what's the name of the Hudson Taylor's mission organization? Do you remember? The China Inland Mission or something like that. But he was a doctor, I believe, and went in and did medical missions. His was one of the first things where they, you know, so much had gone on in China. Look, it's a wonder. You read about the history of missionaries and trade, Europeans trade in China. It's a wonder the Chinese don't hate us more than they do as far as Westerners and Christians. They would go in and just cause all kinds of problems. And so Hudson Taylor went in at a time where his philosophy was, if I go in with the support or money of a government here, then I'm going to be tied to the Chinese impression of me, to what the Chinese impression of that government is. And so he went in, no strings attached, no connections. He said, I want to be able to operate as an ambassador of Christ, not as a citizen of wherever. And his fantastic biography, if you want to pick up a biography to read, his name, Hudson Taylor, again, is really compelling. Women got involved in the mission movement. They were able to do things that in the U.S. and in Western Europe they weren't allowed to do, preaching, teaching, leading. And unfortunately, this is one of those things where our sin ended up playing a role to our benefit. It was predominantly because of racism. You know, what a lot of Westerners, you know, Europeans and Americans felt like, we won't allow these women to do those things here, but if they go to Africa, well, those are inferior citizens, and so women can go over there and teach and preach and lead churches and do stuff there. The modern mission movement was one of the chief contributors to the feminist movement in the Western world. Because all of a sudden, women are going and seeing incredible results and seeing their skills and abilities flourish in these places. And then all of a sudden, they come back home and people are like, well, why can't they do that here? you know, why aren't those things allowed in other places? women played very significant roles. The British, another name, David Livingstone, was an Anglican missionary. If you go to, it was predominant in Africa. If you go to Victoria Falls, is one of the big tourist areas on the Zambian-Zimbabwean border. The city in Zambia where you go into, if you go to Victoria Falls, is called Livingstone. It's named after a Christian missionary that went there. Christian missionaries, obviously, from the Dutch into South Africa. The spread into Latin America was very predominant as well. But some of the big trends, when you think about benefits, it was interdenominational cooperation has and continues to be a big thing with the missionary movement. Giving women a role of service that would continue to grow and expand, another significant outflowing. Right, wrong, or indifferent, the white Christian, European American, felt like we need to take all of these modern benefits of civilization, industrialization and education and things, and it's our Christian beliefs, it's our responsibility to take those to the rest of the world. And that has, for the history of the mission movement, has been a combination of positives and negatives. It has helped with education around the world, literacy around the world, medical advancements around the world. At the same time, not everything about the consumer world that we operate in the Western world has been beneficial in other places. You've seen places where societies had learned to survive and live and had done so for centuries based on their systems of living. And now they look a lot like we do, with the wealthy becoming more and more and more and more wealthy and the poor becoming more and more and more poor. They look like industrialized England and France in A Tale of Two Cities or Les Miserables, whereas before it was, very, very different. And so it's a combination of things. But we do see, I think without a doubt you can see the benefit of the kingdom of God advancing in a spiritual sense. 50 years ago, 100 years ago for sure, there are places you could go around the world and the population of Christianity would be very, very small or negligible or non-existent. And today, you go most places and you'll find Christian communities just about anywhere in the world with indigenous members, indigenous leaders. They may be really small numbers still, but it's to our benefit that the church in China is growing and developing its identity as Chinese followers of Jesus instead of feeling like they have to become Westerners in order to be a follower of Jesus. A lot of what our guest that spoke about Hinduism and ministry in India said applies in Africa, applies in Latin America, applies all over Asia, that you shouldn't have to become like a Western American in order to be a Christian. There ought to be expressions of following Jesus that are biblical, that in principle are much like ours, but cultural, are at home in the places where all of these people live. And so we continue to learn the way we do missions, the way we think about it. We continue to learn and grow and hopefully progress and develop. But the modern missionary movement has been a very integral part of Christianity becoming a global family instead of just a European or Euro-American family. So for that, we ought to be thankful and appreciative. So questions or comments about modern missionary movement? We got 2 weeks left. We're gonna meet again next week and then on May 4th. And so 2 more weeks, we'll wrap up. Garrett's on next week. I'm up on the 4th. And so we invite you to hang out for those last 2 weeks and see it through to the end. He's got the syllabus. I don't have a copy of it with me. This was 32 and 33. If you're following in your book with the reading, I would just read 34 and 35 probably. So, anyways, blessings to you guys. You'll have a good rest of your week.